joy. The fourth talk in a series on the fruit of the Spirit was presented by Ron Julian on July 9, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, good morning. We're going to continue in our look at the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. Once again, I remind you, you probably don't need to turn to Galatians 5 because we won't be looking at it. We want to talk about the concept of one of those fruits of the Spirit and try to understand something of how Paul looks at it, what he means, what is involved in the particular one we're looking at today. Let me remind you of the context very briefly. Paul, in response to the Judaizers, and those who have been listening to the Judaizers, is basically at a point in his argument where he's trying to convince them that legalism leads to a fake moral transformation. If I have this emphasis on, here are the set of rules, and you know that I'm a good guy because I have kept these rules, it leads to a kind of a change. I'm the sort of person who keeps those rules, as opposed to somebody who doesn't keep those rules, but it's not really a true moral transformation. And one of the ways you can tell that it isn't is by the characteristics of it, that it is still characterized by what Paul calls the flesh, especially self-righteousness, judgmentalism. You can see in the fruit of legalism what's really back behind it. Although it claims to have produced a moral transformation, it's really leading to a kind of spiritual ugliness. The true moral transformation comes through the Spirit of God. And that comes to those not who have demonstrated their worth by keeping a set of rules, even a set of good rules, but those who have been forgiven for their true guilt before God by the basis of what Jesus did on the cross. It is those who will find the true moral transformation. So as opposed to the idea that legalism, the law, promotes goodness, Paul's argument back is no, it is being freed from the requirement to fulfill the law that leads to true moral transformation. Therefore, if I am going to follow God and be intent on the things of faith, then that true moral transformation is what I ought to be pursuing. And if I find my life given over to judgmentalism, self-righteousness, and so on, then I need to ask myself, am I following the gospel? Is God at work in me, or is there something else going on? That's what Paul is doing in this section. The particular fruit of the Spirit I want to talk about today is joy. This is a very simple idea, you would think. Joy, I mean, what's hard to understand, but it's actually kind of challenging to talk about, I think. I don't think I probably have to explain to you why it's challenging to talk about. I don't imagine that there are very many of us here that have not gone through bouts of feeling bad. I mean, I just say right up front that I often feel bad. I wrestle with depression, with discouragement, with a sorrow over my own failings and sins, the ways I have hurt other people. I mean, there's a lot to be sorrowful about in life, and I have certainly wrestled with that. So I myself, when I come to this description of joy being the fruit of the Spirit, Paul very definitely has my attention. What does he mean? What exactly is he getting at here? If joy is a fruit of the Spirit, then what is joy? What does it look like? Does the fact that I'm discouraged at times mean that I don't have the fruit of the Spirit in me, and therefore I must not be a believer? I mean, what exactly is Paul getting at here? So it seems to me to be a pretty important question. It's been an important question to me. So I want to talk about today what I think is behind this, what Paul means by joy and what he means by joy being a fruit of the Spirit. So what is joy? Let's start with that. Let me start out by, as I often do, talking first about what I think joy is not. It's pretty easy for us to fall into the trap of thinking that joy is happiness. That is, if I feel good about everything, if I'm up, if I'm feeling excited and bubbly and enthusiastic, then I must have joy. And if I'm not feeling that way, then I don't have joy. What's interesting to me is that when you look in the Bible, it's pretty clear that at the same time that it talks about joy, it does not eliminate the possibility that we would feel bad in the midst of it. There's a striking example of that. Paul goes through this list in 2 Corinthians of a description of his situation as an apostle. And I think he kind of means it to represent all of the apostles, the difficulties of their situation. He describes himself as sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. And that's a very striking sort of combination of ideas. On the one hand, his life is filled with sorrow. And I think he means that. If you look at Paul's description of his life and his ministry and his circumstances, he wrestled with a lot of stuff. In fact, in this very context, he describes the difficulties that he goes through that might very well lead to sorrow and struggle in life. He describes his life as being in much endurance, in afflictions, in hardships, in distresses, in beatings, in imprisonments, in tumults, in labors, in sleeplessness, in hunger. That's the abundant Christian life that Paul was leading at the time. It was tough. His ministry was tough. Many of the people that he preached to wrote him off, especially his fellow Jews, which we know was an emotionally devastating thing to him. It really tore him up that so many of his people, the chosen people of God, at this point in history, were not going to listen to the gospel. And many of those who didn't listen to the gospel took their hostility out on Paul. In the churches that he founded, it's not enough. You go, you preach the gospel, you found a church, and you go away and you say, okay, well, at least those folks are taken care of. Well, no, that's not the way it went. Most of the churches that he founded gave him grief. He talks about the daily pressures of the churches, of his concern for the churches. I mean, he's hearing all the time. Here comes this letter. Well, this new group has come in. They're preaching a different gospel, and everybody's going crazy for it. And then over here, well, there's a whole faction in this group that's decided that you're not an apostle, and you're a hick, and we don't need to listen to you. And, I mean, this was his experience, his concern for the church as a personal existential experience was a difficult one. And in his letters, we can see it. I mean, he pours out his heart at various places. He's troubled. He's distressed. At one point, he describes himself as essentially declared himself to be dead. Things are so tough. Things are so bad. I am so oppressed by all of this that I'm just drawing a line and saying, I'm dead. And I am trusting in the God who raises the dead. Life can be tough. It was tough for Paul. It was tough for Jesus. This joy that they're talking about can accompany great distress and sorrow and trouble. If I get the idea somehow, well, you couldn't expect me to be joyful because look at all the troubles I have, that's not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is that joy is something that accompanies troubles in this life. Paul describes one group. He says of them, in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. He's talking about their giving, talking about their actually helping out those who are in trouble. But they did it out of their in a great ordeal of an affliction and deep poverty. But the interesting thing is that he says it came from their abundance of joy. So joy in his mind is something that is not incompatible with difficulties, afflictions, and poverties. Those things can go together. And of course, the classic statement of this is in the book of James, where he says, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials." I mean, this is just right in your face. Joy, be joyful when things are difficult. Now, there's more to it than that, but in essence, that's at the heart of it. What is it then? If it's not happiness and not that feeling you have when all your troubles are gone, what is it? This is not an easy question, but here's what I understand so far. Here's what I see in the Bible and what is making sense to me at this point. Joy, as the Bible uses it, is that natural response that we have when we believe that something good has come or is coming our way. I mean, it is the response I have to goodness, that is, to blessing, to something I want. We see all kinds of uses of the word in the Bible like that. In the parable, a man knows there is a hidden treasure in a field, and so he goes with joy and buys the field. But what's the joy over? He knows there's this great treasure in the field. He is joyful. There is a sense of satisfaction and delight that comes from the fact that he knows there is this treasure in this field. He is about to pay everything he has to get the field. So in one sense, you could say there is this loss that he's going through. Everything he's got, he's paying it for the field. But he knows in the end that he's not really losing, he's gaining. And so he is joyous. Bible talks about a woman who forgets the pains of labor because of her joy when the child is born. The father has joy when the prodigal son returns home. The disciples had great joy when they discovered that Jesus had risen from the dead. Joy is that response of satisfaction and delight in how things have turned out or how things are going to turn out. And that's important because we can start to see then how it's possible for joy to coexist with sorrow and suffering in the Christian life. On the one hand, this is a hard life. We have troubles. The world is still full of sin. I mean, there's selfishness and greed and self-preoccupation, and we hurt each other, and we can be difficult to live with. There's still death in the world. There's still physical suffering in the world. There's a lot to cry about in the world, and the Bible does not forbid me to cry. Even Jesus cried. He cried at the death of Lazarus. He cried over the thought of the upcoming suffering that he was going to go through. And yet, on the other hand, knowing as we do that the world is a difficult place, we also know that God is going to triumph over it all. Sin will be destroyed. Death is not final. It is going to be overturned. The aching need that we feel in our hearts is going to be finally and completely fulfilled. I mean, that's what the gospel says. We are at war with a powerful enemy, and we feel the sorrows of that war. But we know that the enemy is losing the battle, and one day will be defeated. We know the outcome of this war in advance. Not many times that you have the opportunity to fight in a war where you know the outcome in advance. And so, knowing what we do, we rejoice. The idea of joy in the Bible is intimately tied to the idea of hope. In fact, Paul uses that phrase sometimes explicitly. In Romans 12, he talks about rejoicing in hope. What is the foundation of our joy? We have a hope. Okay, Now, if all of that Tony almost caught me. I was going to say in a nutshell. I won't. I'm trying to wean myself of the habit. In a nutshell, that was my picture of how joy works. Okay, having said that, we're in a position to understand something then of how joy is a fruit of the Spirit. This is the point that I'm trying to make over and over again in this series. If we think of the fruit of the Spirit as being this sort of magical, at one time I didn't feel this way, but the Spirit has sort of filled me with these feelings. It comes from somewhere, I just don't know where it is, but I have this feeling of love, and I have this feeling of joy. That's not at the heart of what Paul is picturing. Love is a fruit of the Spirit, as we had been talking about. Joy is a fruit of the Spirit because of the work that the Spirit is doing in changing our understanding of life. It is not a magical inner glow. It is not immediate or automatic. But the Spirit of God, as we could see over and over and over and over again in the Bible, the Spirit of God is at work to overcome my hostility to the truth, to give me eyes to see and ears to hear. I didn't used to get it. You could have talked about the hope of the gospel in front of me and it wouldn't have meant anything to me, but it means something to me now. Why does it come to mean something to me? Because the Spirit of God is at work. Bit by bit, through the struggles and trials of my life, I am coming to see. And in as much as I am coming to see, then there are certain things that result from that. It is my understanding, the strength of my faith, that the Spirit is working on. And the fruit of that, then, is a renewed understanding that leads to a different perspective that ultimately leads to love and joy and so on. Now, this is a passage that I have talked about many times here, and I won't go into a lot of detail in it, but one of the things I like about this passage is it really does help us to see how Paul thinks about this. There are other passages where he does this as well, but this one is very striking to me. I'm just going to look at one verse from it. This is Romans 15, verse 13. Where, I'm not going to go into all of the setting for it this time, maybe another time I will, but in verse 13 he says, "Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit." Again, there are a couple of things that are striking about what Paul is praying for here. First of all, he's asking that God would fill them with all joy and peace in believing. It is the believing that is the grounds, that is the foundation upon which the joy and the peace are built. Why am I joyful? Because I have come to believe. And this is the biblical picture. If I try to base joy in this life on how satisfying is life at the moment, how free am I from suffering, how free am I from the ravages of sin in my own life and in the lives of the people around me, then I'm not going to be able to rejoice. I might at times be able to be mildly happy, or I might be able to even be deliriously distracted. But if I stop and think about what's going on around me, I'm not going to be able to be joyful for long. The biblical picture is my joy is rooted in the unchangeable character of God, the goodness of God, the love of God, and the fact that God has promised to redeem His creation. We're on a journey, as I say probably every week, and we're on a journey to the place that is most desirable to be. I'm on a journey toward the fulfillment of my life. If I believe that, if I really get a hold of that and say, yes, this is in fact the hope of my life, I am confident that it will happen and I long for it to happen, then that becomes the foundation for joy. His prayer is that God would fill us with joy in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. He has tied hope and joy and believing all together, and it is the power of the Holy Spirit that brings this about in abundance. So we can see here why Paul talks about joy as a fruit of the Spirit. It is the Spirit, the power of the Spirit at work, that brings my faith home to me, that makes it a living, dynamic quality in my own life, so that I have a foundation to stand on. I have something to rejoice in. And I might just say in passing, I don't want to go over this part today. This is a topic that deserves a lot of talk on its own. But there is a corollary to this. Not only am I coming to believe that God is faithful in what He has promised to do, but through the trials of my life, as the Spirit is building this conviction in me, that also gives me sort of, that's the rubber meets the road sort of test in life, that something is going on in me, that God is really at work in me. And so that increases the joy as well. Because not only am I joyful that God is going to save the world, but I have a personal feeling that I am going to be saved in the middle of this process because I can see what God has begun to do in me already. It is the Spirit of God that ultimately is responsible to bring our faith to the place of maturity where we can have that kind of confidence and thus that kind of joy. Here's the bottom line as I see it. There is this dynamic that I'm trying to talk about through all of these fruits of the Spirit that we're talking about. On the one hand, we're talking about a supernatural activity of God. God at work, the Spirit of God at work, transforming my heart. A miraculous thing. Paul describes it at times in terms, he talks about the power that created the universe. You look around at the entire cosmos and God, the huge power of God that put all that together, has been brought to bear on my heart. It's this miracle that I am actually seeing what there is to be seen, if indeed I am. And yet the miracle is not something that happens to me apart from the choices I make and the struggles that I make with these issues. It comes to me through those struggles and through those choices. That's why, on the one hand, Paul can say that joy is the fruit of the Spirit, and yet he can turn right around and exhort us to rejoice. Now, when Paul exhorts us to rejoice, when you put the whole thing together, he's not just saying, you're not feeling good right now, cut it out. Feel good right now. That doesn't make any sense. Who can do that? I mean, you can fake it if you want, but there's nothing significant that comes of that in the end. I mean, if you've ever tried to do that, there is no lasting change of life that can come from just trying to convince yourself that you feel something that you don't. I mean, that's not going to get you anywhere. The encouragement to rejoice is really a hidden sort of exhortation to believe. It is to go back and remember, to remind yourself, what is it that's true? What reason do I have to rejoice? Paul, you say I should rejoice? What reason do I have to rejoice? Let me tell you all of the difficult things that I'm going through. Let me tell you all of the things that I wish I had that I don't have. Let me tell you all the people who are beating up on me. Let me tell you how I have trashed my own life through my own foolish and sinful choices. And you're telling me to rejoice? Actually, yeah, he does. That's in 1 Thessalonians 5:16. I think he's really driving home that very point. Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. In everything, give thanks. And his whole point there in that always and without ceasing and in everything is, I'm talking about in the times of life when it is tough. I'm talking about in the times of life when you look around and you don't have anything now that you're particularly joyful about. You're not particularly thankful about the lot in life that you have at the moment. But why would you rejoice? I come back to that question. Paul, you're telling me to rejoice. What do I have to rejoice about? The God of the universe is taking a broken creation and making it whole. He's taking a creation in which there is death, and he is throwing death away. He's taking a creation in which there is sin, and he is abolishing sin. No more selfishness. No more lack of love. No more lack of love for God. Everyone will know God and love each other. He's taking away futility and frustration. He's making a new heavens and a new earth. One where decay is not the order of the day. Things don't fall apart in this creation. Things get better. That's what he's doing. And if I'd like to have a part in that, I can. Psalm 30 says, His anger is but for a moment. His favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may last for the night, but joy comes in the morning. That is a very biblical sort of idea. God is quite willing to take us through a season of trial, a season of education, of learning, of discipline. But in the end, it's all working toward temporary afflictions bringing about a permanent state of good. That's what I have to rejoice in. I mean, you know perfectly well that if right at this moment I could convince you that coming down the line for you is this incredible good, this thing that you just desire above everything. I mean, we could do it in crass terms. You would get the point right away if I could somehow say, you know, I happen to know that Bill Gates has left you all his money and he's not feeling very well. I mean, you'd feel, oh, that poor Bill, that's tough, but how many billions was that? I mean, this would get your attention. The idea that this was coming to you in this world would transform the way you thought about your situation. The problem is that the promises of the gospel can seem very elusive to us. Why is it that joy is such a difficult thing to come by, the kind of joy that we're talking about here? It's because it is so easy to get focused on the stuff all around me and to lose sight of what it is that, in fact, God is really doing. You and I have it backwards. It seems to us that the promises of the gospel are this sort of ghostly sort of thing on the horizon that just barely has any form, and we have to keep convincing ourselves that it's real, when, in fact, this world that we live in is a ghostly and insubstantial thing in comparison. Its days are numbered. You can hear it wheezing already. It's going. And there is this unshakable reality that is going to be in its place. It's real. It's the kind of thing when it comes in, it just blows everything else out of the place. We don't see it that way. And you understand when I say this, I'm not up here saying, what's the matter with you guys? I mean, I'm the same way. It's so easy to get distracted. But the fact is, this is the struggle of the Christian life. This is what it's about now. I firmly believe that our lives now, whatever it is that may be going on, at the heart of it, the reason that God has us continuing on in this age is that this is the opportunity for us to come to terms with these big questions. This is the opportunity for me to turn away from my inherent mistrust of God and actually believe what he says. When we think about the ups and downs of the Christian life, the fact that we often feel challenged, feel unhappy, feel fearful, and so on, and that maybe joy sometimes is not the first word that comes to mind to describe how I feel about life. What does that mean? Where does that leave us? Well, I think on the one hand, this is the important thing about this. On the one hand, it's natural. On the one hand, every person of God, every mature believer in the Bible, even Jesus himself, the man without sin, suffered in this world. And they felt the weight of the sins of this world and the death in this world. They were not glib. They didn't just say, oh, it's okay. They suffered. It's appropriate. There is loss in the world, and we mourn over the loss. It makes sense. So on the one hand, we don't want to beat ourselves up for feeling sorrowful about sorrowful things. But on the other hand, there is what seems to be a cousin of sorrow, a whole set of cousins of sorrow that we need to be very wary of. Despair, discontent. The fact is that we have been told what God is up to. We can't be complacent about a genuine refusal on our part to rejoice. The fact is, very, very good things are coming our way. God knows what he's doing. This is going to happen. It's in the process of happening right now. We can feel the winds blowing already. And God is in the process now, even in the midst of our sufferings, of doing things in our lives that are just the first little sprouts of something ultimately that is going to be huge and wonderful. That's what we've been told, and we have every reason to believe it. So the question we must face is, will we believe? We live in a world that sends us a message that says you need all kinds of things to be content. You need money, you need power, you need a certain kind of lifestyle. I mean, there are a whole series of messages out there. The problem is that there's a glimmer of truth to it. It's not as if I, as a human being, am not made in such a way that I respond to certain things in this world. It's not a perversion that I prefer peace to war, that I prefer plenty to poverty. I mean, it only makes sense. There are things in this life that are desirable, and it's not wrong to desire them. But the question is, have I set my desires on the most important things? It's like somebody saying to me, give me that $5 bill that you've got, and I'll give you a blank check. Well, I could look at it and say, yeah, but I need that $5. I mean, what am I going to do if I don't have that $5? I was going to spend it on this over here. Yeah, okay. And your point would be, I mean, the problem is, you're so focused on this little thing that you've got that you've lost sight of what it is you stand to gain. In the end, it is nothing less than the fulfillment of every bit of my humanity. Eternity spent knowing God, knowing you the way I would like to know you, and being fulfilled as a human being in every way. That's That's what the comparison is. The world is telling me I have certain needs. And it's not wrong about that, but where it's gone wrong is in telling me how it is I'm going to find those needs fulfilled. So, the choice to rejoice ultimately is a choice to believe. Now, the good news is that weak as I am, I'm just not going to be able to do this on my own. And the picture is, this is a work of the Spirit of God. In that I find great comfort. But nonetheless, the choice remains to be made. If I refuse to acknowledge that there is this great thing coming my way, and to find contentment in that, to find satisfaction in that, to find a satisfaction that trumps sorrow ultimately. It doesn't eliminate it, but it says to my sorrow, this is a thing of the moment. If I will not go there, if I refuse to go there, then there is something wrong. Because that's the very fundamental implication of the thing that we say we believe. And I think that's what Paul's doing in his list of the fruit of the Spirit. On the one hand, he's saying it is the Spirit of God working in the lives of those who are forgiven for their sins that produces this kind of transformation. And then he turns around at the end and says, if we live by the Spirit, let us line up with the Spirit. That is, let us see what it is that the Spirit is really doing in the world and say to ourselves, yes, that's what I want to be about. So in the end, I think, there's a message of encouragement here. I am looking to God. I can cry out to God confidently. If I am feeling overwhelmed by life, I can cry out to God, give me perspective, give me wisdom, give me eyes to see, so that I might rejoice. And that's the kind of prayer that he answers. But at the same time, it's the kind of prayer he answers by putting me in situations where I must choose. Am I going to rejoice or not? Okay, well, let's take a few minutes and have any questions or comments you might have. Logan, is that your hand? Yeah, okay.
Just a small technical question. Can you give me examples of this word joy in other manuscripts at the time, or other contexts?
Well, I can't remember at the moment anything to quote to you. I would argue if I'm remembering, I didn't look at more of those, but if I'm remembering what I have seen in the past, it's a similar sort of, not that it's joy in the coming kingdom of God, but the idea is it is that response to a desirable thing. What makes it complex, as I'm saying, is that we live in a world where things are far from desirable, but we know and believe that they are even now heading in the direction of that which is desirable above all. And so, sorrow, dissatisfaction on the one hand, and yet satisfaction and joy on the other hand, that's the Christian life.
Just to be repetitive, because it's, I feel like sometimes I'm always saying the same thing. And I think I know what your answer will be, but I just would like to hear it again. When you talk about refusing to acknowledge the good coming, things like that, things like we need to be wary of despair, all those things, it would be helpful to me to have it also acknowledge that just like we can't all of a sudden change our mood, well, I mean, we can listen to music, we can jump up and down, we can take drugs, coffee works for me sometimes, but that there's not really a value to that of any depth, that if we are despairing, it's not, the choice in front of us is not refuse to despair. You're struggling to, you're with doubt, okay, just stop that, but to strive towards believing, to keep and to strive towards hoping.
Right. I think that's right, because that's why the Bible so often describes our faith as something that matures, because it is a process. I can't at this moment say I am going to ratchet up the strength of my faith to such a degree that it overwhelms the emotional state I am in and transforms it immediately. But what I do face at those times when despair is my opponent is, what am I going to do with this? I could listen to it and say it's right and give up. Or I could say, you know, this is how I feel about it, but I know it's not the right answer. And I don't know how to exactly talk myself out of this, but I'm going to remind myself of the truth, and I'm going to cry out to God for His mercy to help me understand that truth, so that there's a real answer to despair in my life. Right. So, yeah, it's very tricky. That's why, I mean, the Bible kind of emphasizes both of these things. There's the exhortation, and then yet there's the continued assurance that we're praying to God to do this. This is a fruit. If we come down too hard on the exhortation side, then it starts to sound like that, well, so, you know, pick yourself up and get this together, and why aren't you feeling this way? And that's not the picture. And yet, I can't just give myself a pass and say, oh, that's all right. Because it's not all right. This is the arena. This is the place where I am facing the issue of my faith. I mean, not that it's always despair is the place. I mean, there are all kinds of issues that we face. But if it is at that spot of despair, then that is the place where I am confronting the question, is the gospel true? And is it going to have an immediate impact on despair? It can happen. I won't say that it won't happen. Does it usually happen that way? I'm not God. But in my experience of life so far, I would suggest that probably most of the time it does not happen that way. It is a process. It is a struggle with occasional outbursts of clarity that kind of notch, you know, move things up a notch. Every now and again, God really brings it home to us in a way that really makes sense. But yeah, this is the danger. It's always the danger in these sort of things. If I say God does it, then we're tempted to just sort of say, okay, well, I'll just let God do it and forget it. If I say do it, then the danger is that it becomes this sort of demand and this burden that I feel that I can't fulfill, and then I try to fake it, and it's just bad. What I'm saying is, today, or sometime soon in your life, you're going to face questions that call upon you to decide what you believe is true. Fundamental things about, is there a God, and what has He promised, and do I want what He has promised? Do I believe in His love, and so on? And it's in the middle of those places that my faith is going to be moving either in the direction of God or away from Him. Roger?
Well, let me get this straight. Joy is how the way we feel in the midst of our trials, knowing that there's something good that's at the end of the struggle. We go through the struggle because we know that there's something good at the end. Can you take a few minutes and give us your picture, or what you think the biblical picture is of the end of the line? What is out there waiting for us?
Let's see, lots of money. Well, It seems to me that the story of the Bible is God coming along. It has two focuses, foci. On the one hand, it turns a spotlight on this world and our experience in this world. And it says, here's the deal. Here's where you are. Here's the problem. You're the kind of people that God could take a whole bunch of you and miraculously free you from slavery with the Egyptians, part the Red Sea in front of your eyes, walk through on dry land, send manna from heaven, send water from the rocks. I mean, he could do miracle after miracle. And your conclusion at the end of it would be, we can't trust him, we better go back to Egypt. That's the kind of people you are. And being those kinds of people has brought death and destruction and misery into the world. The other focus of the Bible is on God's solution to the problem. And his solution is, it has its part that's happening now, which is the calling out of his people, bringing understanding, faith, perseverance, hope, encouragement into the lives of his people now, with the end that they would arrive at his ultimate outcome. The ultimate outcome, as I see the Bible describing it, is this world will be recreated. Jesus, the man who is God incarnate, will rule over all creation in righteousness. He will be the head of the entire world. Every one of his people will be citizens in that kingdom. They will be freed from sin. They will live forever. They will find life. God will pour out his kindness on them eternally, as Paul says. Now, when we start beyond that, the Bible doesn't get real specific. I have to believe that life in the age to come has a relationship to this life. That is, God didn't take me through this life teaching me things about, like, the satisfaction of work, of creating, you know, of things like that, only to take me into the kingdom of heaven and have me sit on a cloud and sing holy, holy, holy all day long. The life in the age to come is the fulfillment of my humanity, not the negation of it. And so somehow, what I have come to understand about being a human being is still going to have relevance in the age to come. But the things that thwart me now, you'd read the book of Ecclesiastes. The problem is I can't get anything going here. Whatever it is I try to get going, decay happens to it, and death happens to it. I build up a big treasure, and I die, and it goes to somebody else I don't even know. I mean, Robbie has talked about the sort of sad feeling that she gets going to antique stores. You see some very old picture frame with, you know, an old picture from 100 years ago or something like that, or an old chest of drawers or something, and think about, this used to belong to somebody. This used to be their picture. They knew the people in this picture, and those people meant something to them. And those people are dead, and the person that owned the picture is dead, and now I can buy it and use it as a decoration in my house. People that I don't even know who they are. I don't even know their names, but it looks nice. I still remember a sermon on Ecclesiastes that Ray Ortland gave many years ago, where he said, so are you going to find, some people say they're going to find immortality through their descendants. He said, oh yeah? So name your great-grandparents to me. How many people know? You know, it's not, it just doesn't work that way. So the life to come is a life where death does not rob us of the fruit of our work. I can build something and it will last. I can accomplish something, and I will live to enjoy the fruits of it. I mean, it seems to me that all of that has to be a part of what we're talking about in the end. That maybe part of the reason that I know in the church that that we sometimes have a real emphasis on this life and less of an emphasis on our hope is because we kind of have an anemic picture of that hope. I mean, frankly, I mean, this is an amazing thing. I mean, if you stop to think about it, I don't know if this is the way you think about it, but do you know that most Christians, and maybe you're one of them, if you ask them, what is it that the future holds for you, they would say, I'm going to go to heaven. Do you know that that's not what the Bible says? The Bible doesn't say we're going to go to heaven. I mean, I'm not talking about, there's this debate about what happens to you when you die. I'm not talking about that. There may be a time when I go to heaven, when I die, but that is not the hope of my life. The Bible doesn't talk over and over again about the hope of my life being I'm going to die and go to heaven. The hope of my life is Jesus is going to return. There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. And I'm going to live on the new heavens and the new earth forever. I'm going to be recreated. I mean, I'm going to live life. If I get this picture that, oh boy, I'm going to go to heaven forever, and they wear white robes and they play harps. I mean, we don't have much better of a picture of things than that. Well, the way I do it for myself is, in my own life, I look at the sorrow that comes from my own sin, and I think about the day when I will never be that way again, about the joy that comes from responding rightly to people instead of wrongly, seeing the good and going for it with all my heart instead of being reluctantly sort of dragged into it. That sounds great to me. I think about death, and death is gone. I look at the things of this life where human needs, human desires, God-given aspects of my humanity get thwarted and cut off and frustrated. And I think my life in the kingdom of God is the place where those things don't happen anymore. And I think that's as explicit as we can get. If anybody knows any more details, you can tell me afterwards. I don't know if I will believe you, but if any of you have had a vision lately, but that's, I mean, that I think all of that would seem to me to be what the Bible is getting at. Okay, well, we're out of time. Thanks. We'll continue next week.